Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Bombers killed from 50 to more than 70 people, according to reports still coming in, as Iraqis were leaving Friday prayer at a Shiite mosque in Baghdad today. We spoke to Borzu Daragahi, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, earlier today, just after he'd raced to the scene.
There's a hospital really close to the bombing. We just left the scene of the bombing, and we're near that hospital just talking to some of the wounded and recently released from the hospital. At this point, they weren't letting us into the hospital. There's a lot of security vehicles in the area. They've closed the area off to all but official traffic. There's a lot of tension in the air. A lot of guys with machine gun mounted pickup trucks, apparently from various Shiite militias with ties to the Interior Ministry, driving around very angrily.
What was the scene of the bombing like? How, I mean, it sounds pretty bad.
Oh, it was just horrible, Ron. I mean, there was just body parts everywhere. There was blood and gore. There was the at one point I asked someone, how do you know that this was women wearing these suicide belts? And the gentleman pointed me to the a leg, and so there's the bomber's leg. It's a woman's leg, and you can see that it was a woman's leg, and there was her hair, and they were piling her body parts into a separate pile, possibly for genetic testing later.
So there is an assumption it was suicide bombers and as you say, women.
Apparently there was, according to witnesses and according to officials at this point, it was three women wearing explosive-packed suicide belts. The first explosion was just outside of the mosque as parishioners were leaving. The other two used the chaos caused by the first explosion to enter into the mosque, into the courtyard of the mosque, where there were two more explosions, where we have scores of casualties, at least 40 dead, and 130 injured. Those numbers may rise.
Borzu, what does that say to you, that this might have been women wearing suicide belts?
Well, I think that one of the most important things is to figure out what's going to happen tonight. That's the most interesting thing at this point, is how Shiites are going to react to this. This mosque is a very significant one. It's probably the most important Shiite mosque in Baghdad. It is where it is linked to the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution of Iraq, which is the dominant Shiite political party, and also has a huge militia that's linked to the Interior Ministry. The prayer leader is Jalaluddin Savir, who's like a firebrand Shiite cleric, who is also a member of parliament. And he's known as the most sort of sectarian of the Shiite politicians. What is going to be interesting to see and possibly frightening to see is what the reaction is going to be from the Shiite community.
Because we know after other attacks, remember the Shiite shrine that was bombed in Samarra or attacked in Samarra, there was a wave of attacks following that. That was last February. There was another bombing yesterday outside another Shiite shrine in Najaf. It would seem as if this is the new attack of choice.
It seems like that they've discovered the one thing that can really kind of shake this country is attacking places of worship. Yesterday's attack, just to be clear, was near the shrine, mm-hmm. But it was actually right at the gates of the cemetery, the Najaf Cemetery, which is the most important Shiite cemetery in Iraq and considered hallowed ground as well.
What do you think that these increased attacks are responding to, Borzu?
I think that there's a couple things at work here. I think on the one hand, this is a theory that the U.S. officials propose, is that the Sunni Arab-led insurgency, recognizing that they're not really winning the Hearts and Minds campaign, figures the only way to get the U.S. out and to get their power back is to spark an all-out civil war, make this place such a nightmare that Americans just decide to leave, and then in that chaos they can take over. And on the other hand, there's another theory, is that this, you know, Iraq was an Arab country. It was part of the Arab world, and the Americans came in and they turned it into a Shiite Arab country with closer ties to Iran. And so the people who are doing this, they don't see themselves as killing fellow Arabs or killing fellow Iraqis. They see themselves as, you know, fighting the Iranian influence. Hmm.
Meanwhile, Borzu Daragahi at the hospital near the scene of today's bombing outside a Shiite mosque in northern Baghdad. What are people saying? I mean, you set a scene of incredible tension, but what are you hearing them say? What?
At this point, there's a lot of shock and confusion. I'm not hearing a lot of people calling for revenge and so on, but you don't really need to hear it. You know, you just watch the armed men as they're driving around, really angry, really tense, for no reason, firing their weapons into the air, and you can just tell that they're gearing for a fight.
That they say that we have to revenge, we have to...
Oh, you did hear that? Can we get some quotes from people?
No, just while we are, I am...
Okay.
What
my translator, who was there a little earlier than I was, saying that in fact there were some people who were saying we have to take revenge, we have to retaliate for this. They were very angry. Mm-hmm. So in fact there are some people who are at the scene sort of calling for revenge.
Yeah. Borza, we're going to let you go, but I have one last question. You are an American reporter wandering around with a cell phone doing a report with us. We deeply appreciate it, but do you feel in danger?
They blocked off vehicle traffic, so I don't feel that much in danger. I got my bodyguard kind of keeping an eye out on the scene. And, you know, I mean, I don't do this for every story, but this seemed kind of important enough and significant enough that it was worth it to come out here and to actually see what was happening instead of just taking press releases and making phone calls.
Borza Daragahi, Baghdad bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from near the scene of today's bombing outside a Shiite mosque and worried about what reaction to it might be. Borza, thank you very much for speaking with us. And with that, we lost the line to Borza Daragahi, but we want to say that we were just able to reach him again, and he is fine. Well, for some analysis of the situation in Iraq, we now turn to David Ignatius, a columnist with The Washington Post, who was recently in Baghdad following the efforts by Iraqi leaders to form a unity government there. And David, first, your reaction to what we've just been hearing. Borza Daragahi says today's attacks could be a new trigger for worse violence.
It does seem to me that every time Iraq is getting closer towards some agreement, there's one of these horrific bombings that gets everybody terrified all over again. And, you know, the question is, at some point, will Shiite patients fray, and will there be wholesale revenge attacks? Will Sunnis, in their fear, launch counterattacks? I mean, Iraq always just hangs on that lip of total out-of-control violence.
And, of course, we should point out that some Sunnis say that Shiites already have death squads and militias that have revenge killings. But you were in Baghdad just before Secretary Rice and British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw made that surprise visit to try and push Iraqi leaders along. And as you wrote, Secretary Rice told Iraqis that Americans were becoming impatient with their efforts to form a new government. And you also added that it would be folly if American impatience torpedoed the slow but real progress Iraqi leaders are making toward a government. First question, you know, it's hard to ask for patience of Americans or Iraqis in the face of these attacks.
Well, it is hard, but that doesn't make it any the less appropriate. You know, the truth is that we may end up failing in Iraq. Our efforts to try to create a unity government, to try to create some basis for reconciliation among Iraqis may fail. A country may explode into a flat-out civil war with horrific killing. But I don't think we should be in any rush to see that happen or talk ourselves or the Iraqis into it. As long as there's any chance of bringing people together, I think we ought to work very hard on that. I don't understand people's rush to decide that this has failed, it's over, let's get out. I don't think we're at that point yet.
What about the leadership? Because Borza just was saying that there is a lot of thinking on the ground there, and you may have picked up on this as well, that some of these attacks are from Iraqis who believe that Iraq was once an Arab country and that the new government, backed by the U.S. and pushed by the U.S., is making it more of a Shiite Arab country with much stronger ties to Iran, and they object to that.
Well, Iraq's Sunnis, Sunni Arabs, roughly 20% of the population, do have to accept in their hearts the demographic reality that Iraq is a majority Shiite country, and that, you know, a democratic Iraq inevitably will give more power to Shiite Arab Iraqis than they've had before. I think there are reasons to think that Iraq's Shiite community feels an Arab identity as opposed to a Persian identity. It's obvious that Iran is going to have a stronger influence on that country going forward than it did in the past under Saddam Hussein, and that does make Sunnis very nervous. But I think that that isn't, in the end, a sufficient explanation for what's going on now. What I've seen in Iraq, and this last visit was my 12th visit there since the war began, was a process in which the most violent and extreme people in each community are intimidating the people in the center who basically want what anybody would want. They want an end to the violence. They want secure lives. The tragedy in Iraq is that we have not been able to protect those people, and so they have turned increasingly to militias. I mean, people won't live with insecurity, the threat of death for themselves and their families forever. They'll turn to somebody who can protect them. That somebody, tragically, has not been the United States. It is not yet the Iraqi armed forces and security forces. They're making some progress, but they're not there yet. So people turn to militias. I watched this process happen in Lebanon, covering the civil war 25 years ago, and you know, I'll tell you that once people hunker down, turn to the militias for the guns to keep them alive, it takes a long time to undo that. So that, again, that's why I just think we should be patient. This may not work. If it doesn't work, we will have to take some very difficult, unpleasant decisions. But I don't think we're there yet.
What is the biggest stumbling block to forming a government that Iraqis can turn to? And we should say that current Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri, who's supported by the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, has said he will not step aside, as many are urging him to do. Does that factor into the biggest stumbling block?
For the moment, that is the biggest stumbling block. I have reported that last Sunday, the last of the planks, if you will, of the platform of this government of national unity was agreed to by all the factions. They have literally debated the details, signed off on them, and they're reasonable. They have a structure that if they could agree on the personalities, might provide the beginning of a move back from the edge of the cliff towards something sane. The problem is agreeing on the personalities. Jafri, the current prime minister, backed by the roughest, toughest of the Shiite militias, is demanding to hold on to power. Sunnis and Kurds, I think with some reason, think that Jafri has not been successful as interim prime minister. He's been a weak prime minister. That's probably the most important thing. And in his weakness, he's allowed the sectarian elements, the militias that are hiding under cover of the Iraqi police and interior ministry, free rein. And so we have had these Shiite death squads in the streets, and that frightens people. I think the United States is right to say, which is what our ambassador in Baghdad is saying, we are not going to bankroll a government that doesn't put unity first. We are insisting, as a condition of our helping you, because the Iraqis do want America to hang on and stay until things are a little bit more stable, we're saying we will not help you unless you put unity first. And you know, I think that kind of tough bargaining is appropriate. My own guess would be that you will have a government certainly within the next month. I would be surprised if that government is led by Jafri, but you can never tell.
David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post. He recently returned from Iraq, where he was following efforts of leaders there to form a government. David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And just ahead, we're going to turn our gaze to Washington, where the week ends without any immigration reform. What happened? Also later in the program, Meryl Streep, off script and off the cuff. Much more coming up here and now. It's been in Washington. But today, President Bush put the accent on the positive, noting that unemployment dropped 0.1% from last month, and employers have created more than 5 million new jobs since he took office.
These millions of new jobs are evidence of an economic resurgence that is strong, broad, and benefiting all Americans.
But earlier, at a National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, the president didn't mention the story that's consumed the Washington media. Before the start of the war in Iraq, the news is that he authorized the leak to the New York Times of what is now widely seen as flawed, classified information about Iraq. It has been a tough week in Washington for the president and for Congress, which also today could not come to an agreement on immigration reform. Joining us on the line from Washington is Boston Globe congressional correspondent Rick Klein. And Rick, first of all, what happened on immigration? So many senators trumpeted a bipartisan agreement yesterday afternoon, and it seems that by last night it all fell apart.
It did. All in the space of 12 to 24 hours, everything sort of collapsed under its own weight. I think a couple of things happened. One is that Senate Republican leaders and Majority Leader Frist, I think, may have underestimated the degree of conservative opposition to this deal that was reached. And another thing was that the Democrats were intent on not seeing any further changes to the bill. So the Democrats were blocking any further amendments to the bill, and Republicans were really insisting on something. So we had both sides accusing the other one of holding this up, and it means that they're going to go into this break, as you mentioned, without an immigration bill.
Well, now remind us, yesterday on our program, a practically catatonic reporter, you know, in the midst of all of these swift changes, told us that the new proposal, the compromise, would have created three tiers of immigrants, depending on how long they've been here. Those here 5 years or more could apply for citizenship. Those here between 2 and 5 years would have to go back to the border, but could immediately come back as temporary workers. Those here less than 2 years would have to go home and wait in line for visas. And I say it was very, very complicated, but very much seemed a positive turn. And these provisions were meant to garner support. So why didn't they?
Well, they did garner support. They just didn't garner enough support, I think, is the major issue. There are a number of issues. There are a number of concerns about the whole scenario. The conservatives are saying this whole concept of these immigrants who have been here for between 2 and 5 years having to leave the country for just this, maybe just a few minutes, just literally just touching their foot back in Mexico and then coming right back, makes no sense to them. They say that's as good as an automatic track. So that continues to be a major sticking point for the conservatives. And they want further guarantees of security background checks on the people who are coming to the country, the people who are in the country already. So these are the kind of issues that have sidetracked, and it's just such an enormously complicated area of the law already, and the whole bill is just so broad in its scope and in its impact that you have just many, many different constituencies that are pushing in different directions. And like I said, I think it really collapsed under its own weight.
Well, another issue was also postponed yesterday. The House abandoned efforts to approve a budget because Republicans were unable to agree on spending, whether to cut back or spend more on social programs. So, you know, it seems as if both parties are in disarray.
Yeah, and I think it's more obvious on the Republican side, probably because they're the ruling party right now. Democrats have been fairly united on the immigration bill. Most of them are still supporting this compromise. But it was a bad week for congressional Republicans and for Congress in general, I agree. I mean, this Republican budget deal failed not just because some moderates thought the spending was too deep, but because some conservatives thought there weren't enough spending controls, that it didn't cut enough, essentially. So it just utter disarray, and the fact that they had to pull it off the floor after several hours of debate on Thursday evening was really an embarrassment for Republican leaders. And they really, it was a key test for them, because this was the first major vote since the announcement that Tom DeLay would be resigning. It was the first major vote under John Boehner as majority leader.
Yeah. And then, of course, you also have the fallout from the news yesterday that court papers from that special investigation into the Valerie Plame case alleged that it was President Bush who authorized the leak of some classified information about Iraq before the war. Not, we rush to say, her name as a CIA agent. But still, now how is that playing out?
Well, I Democrats have been, I think, predictable in the response. I mean, a few of them have come out and said, well, President Bush is now obviously the leaker-in-chief, and they've thrown back his words at him, where he said he was going to get to the bottom of the leak, and whoever did the leaking wouldn't be working in the White House anymore. The White House has responded in part just by saying that he is not being accused of actually authorizing the leak of the name of Valerie Plame. I think it's notable, though, that they're not disputing, at least not directly disputing, they're refusing to comment on the allegation that Scooter Libby is raised in these court papers. This is an issue that, you know, it's been going on for many, many months now, actually years, and it seems like every time it begins to fade into the background, there's another new explosive revelation, and certainly the White House would like to be done with it.
Well, also this week, the president was in one of his frequent lately public forums, and he was respectfully told by an audience member he should be ashamed of his policies. It seems as if, I mean, you know, by our count, this has been a tough week for the president. How do you see the White House regrouping yet again?
Well, there's still a lot of buzz about further staff changes after Andy Card makes his exit official, I think, next week. Josh Bolton will be coming in as new chief of staff, and he's been empowered with making some more changes. A lot of talk about maybe a new Treasury secretary. But it gets harder and harder to do this. I mean, this is not an administration that's had a heck of a lot of turnover in the upper echelons. It's hard to do that at this stage, and it's hard to even consider what that would mean. I mean, if you bring in new bodies, new faces, that doesn't necessarily mean you have new new policies or a new way of reaching out to Congress. And all of this is with the congressional elections now 7 months away, many Republicans beginning to fear for their own jobs.
The president must have been very happy to be able to deliver good economic news today.
Well, I think we're seeing a number of Republicans today trumpeting that. A lot of press releases, a lot of press conferences, people talking about the growth in the job numbers. I think the economy, Republicans are viewing the economy as one of the bright spots, at least in the last few months, that they say, look, it's humming along here under Republican policies. So we're going to continue to see, I think, a lot of attention on that as long as the news is relatively good.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. Rick, thank you.
My pleasure.
And staying with politics for just a second, we'll let you know that next week on Here and Now, we'll speak with a Democratic strategist who's also a hunter and a Southerner and says his party can win back the South by letting each region decide their own gun laws. We'll have that and other ideas from the always colorful Steve Jardin. That's next week. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston. Confidence is up in the United States. Despite higher gas prices and interest rates, economists say the American consumer is in a good frame of mind, meaning they're willing to spend money on stuff, which means they're getting more stuff. But then what do they do with all that stuff? Enter the professional organizer. Recently, members of the National Association of Professional Organizers gathered in Boston. Here and Now's Rachel Gottbaum went to find out what do they do.
My name is Standalyn Robertson. The name of my business is Things in Place. I'm a professional organizer. I'm the vice president of NAPO, the National Association of Professional Organizers. We have people from all over the world, 900 people. They're all organizers that are looking for the latest tip that they can take home. They're looking for information. They're looking for products, anything that they can do to help get their clients to the next level.
Now, why did you get into it?
I knew that I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what it was or what it was called. And so I would try to describe it to people, and they go, so you want to be like a wife? And I go, no, I just want to go in and organize their space, and then I want to go home. I read an article about an organizer in New York City, and it brought tears to my eyes because I'm going, that's it. That's what it's called. That's what I want to do.
Tell me about the sessions. What are some of the sessions this week?
There will be a lot of sessions on working with people that are chronically disorganized. There will be sessions on organizing and spirituality.
Organizing as spirituality? What's that?
It's hard to explain, but when you're working with a client, there's something magical that happens during that session. There's just a moment where there's oftentimes hugging, there's tears, they're so excited that for the first time someone in their lives understands what they're talking about and has a solution to this one little thing that's holding them back.
And that's a spiritual connection?
Definitely a spiritual connection.
My name is Erin Elizabeth Wells.
Tell me the name of your session.
The name of my session is Organizing as a Spiritual Practice. I am a professional organizer, but I actually have a background as a minister, and my training is actually through the Harvard Divinity School. And a lot of my work as an organizer is about helping people recognize that this isn't just about the stuff, this is about their life.
Now, what are you teaching people about the spirituality connection to professional organizing?
It's really about ministry. And what I say to organizers when they ask me that question is, think about how many times the client is calling you who is in some major life transition. They've just had a baby. They've just gone through a major career change. They've retired. They've lost a loved one. And sometime in that transition, things fell off course. We're there to support them through that transition and to reach the goal of the new place that they want to be.
Vicki Norris, president of Restoring Order, an organizing products and services company. We have a collection of office products called the Reclaim Your Office Collection. And our Action Center has
Your what center?
Collection. It's called an Action Center. This will help you take action on your paper. And so what you can do is you can put trays or drawers in it based on what you need. Because if you have five trays here, but you only need three, you know what you will do? You will stash in the bottom two.
I'm a stashing criminal here. Okay. So, and this is your book. It's got a picture of you. Tell me about your book.
This is the book. The book is called Restoring Order, same name as my business, Organizing Strategies to Reclaim Your Life. It's the first book of a series on ordering your life. So it's about living your true priorities and making room for what's really important.
My name is Tom Neverman. My company is The Moving Doctor. I'm based in Beverly Hills, California. Basically, if you're moving, you give me the keys to the new house and the old house. You go to the Bel Air Hotel. We oversee and supervise everything, schedule everything, and then we unpack, organize, help ties, color code, make the beds, and you come home to a house that looks like Neiman Marcus. Most of my clients are pretty high-end and celebrity clients. I'm working with Tom Arnold right now. We're moving them into their new house. I worked with Farrah Fawcett. I do a lot of producers and people behind the scenes. And I do have a confidentiality clause, so I can't really mention much
actually,
more.
As professional organizers, we live in a tomb of silence. We are literally at times in our clients' underwear drawers and in their personal financial and business records, so discretion is paramount.
So what's the ballpark range? How expensive could this get?
You know, it varies from a couple of $1,000 to $40,000-$50,000, and that doesn't include the movers.
My name is Erica Salou, and I'm a personal and business organizer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
What's the toughest client?
The chronically disorganized client. You walk into their home and you can't see their floor. A lot of them are hoarders, so they buy and buy and buy. You have to change their thinking, how they think about their things. So it's a real psychological issue. Most of the time they're working with a therapist, and I'm working in conjunction with a therapist, and I'm working with someone like that. Because it's not about the stuff. It's really about what's going on internally for them. They have a really hard time placing different value on different things. Everything is important to them. A little bottle cap has the same importance to them as a book that they're reading at the moment.
And how do you get them to park their stuff?
It's really about challenging their belief system. So it's having them look at things and testing them and saying, okay, so what is the worst thing that would happen if we get rid of this thing? And then having them do it. And then looking back next week or the next couple of days and say, well, how did that feel? And a lot of them realize that once they let go of a lot of these things, that it isn't as horrible as they thought.
Have you ever found dead bodies?
No. That's one thing I have never found. But I find things like animal feces that are hard, you know, a lot of really, you can find some really gross things in people's homes. Like things that are rotting, like old, you know, food and things in places where you wouldn't find food, like not in the kitchen, like in their bathtub. You find bathtubs that aren't usable as bathtubs.
You say you work with a therapist.
So I find out what is going on, what they're working on with their therapist, and also asking their therapist, can you kind of address these issues with the person? Sort of like, what are their life priorities for the next year? Because I want to make sure if someone knows their life priorities, then they can see what doesn't support that in my life. What can I let go of? So I can get also the background of the person, what kind of like trauma have they had? Do they have an eating disorder? All that stuff. Their ADD, because I can work with someone in different ways if I know that they're ADD. So knowing that and also getting insight from a therapist is really tremendously helpful.
How's business?
It's really, really, really booming. I've been in business 3 years. My business has been growing really rapidly.
Can I just get your name, sir, and what you're selling here?
Oh, well, I'm Harold Taylor. I'm selling myself. Actually, it's Harold Taylor Time Consultants.
What is a time consultant?
Well, it's supposed to be a person who tells you how to more effectively utilize your time.
Uh-huh.
So you can lead a fuller and more successful life. How's that sound?
How do you do it?
With difficulty. Because you can't manage time, you can only manage yourself.
How'd you get into this?
I got into it through necessity about 35 years ago when I ended up with bleeding ulcers and a broken marriage and a bankrupt business, and I decided that maybe working faster wasn't doing it for me and working longer wasn't doing it for me.
Is there a basic philosophy behind time management?
It's probably not doing more things, but doing more important things. In other words, we can't do everything, but we can do anything. So really, time management is more like I look at it as a not-to-do list. You know, what are all the things you can eliminate in your life and still get by so you have room for the things that are important?
Can't do everything. Oh, sorry, I've been taking notes. Sounds from the National Association of Professional Organizers Convention, harvested for us by producer Rachel Gottbaum. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And many of you responded after our interview with Tara Parker Pope of The Wall Street Journal. She did a roundup report on several recent studies on the value of vitamins. Most of those studies concluded that vitamins either did no good or, worse, did harm, and concluded also that vitamins were more effective for people in generally good health. Well, many of you appreciated the conversation, and if you want to read her article yourself, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll link you to it. Now, we did raise questions in our talk about the credibility of the studies, but Christina Shetterly of Medford, Oregon, said that wasn't enough. She writes, "I have suffered several serious health problems, including cancer, and I have recovered in large part due to the use of supplements and alternative health care. If our food sources were as rich in nutrients as they once were, perhaps her arguments would have some validity. But today it is critical to supplement with vitamins to get proper nutrition." Well, this week we also spent some time on a proposed health plan here in Massachusetts, which would require that all residents have health insurance or be fined. In addition, Governor Mitt Romney's office was quoted as saying that research showed that it's not single mothers that make up the bulk of the uninsured, as thought. It's young white males. Well, Rick Evans of Randolph, Massachusetts, weighed in. He writes, "I am a 56-year-old white male with no health insurance. I have never used a penny of free or government-subsidized health care. I have saved and invested a substantial nest egg in case of a health care rainy day. But because I'm willing to pay my bills, I'm labeled an irresponsible free rider by state legislators who have, well, free health care." Following our story on the controversy over an academic paper that said that a so-called Israel lobby is not only influencing but controlling U.S. foreign policy, we heard from Nancy Dorfman of Belmont, Massachusetts. She writes, "You began your report by saying that white supremacist David Duke had seized on this study to support his anti-Semitic claims. That seemed gratuitous. If a program like Here and Now is not open to exploring rational criticism of this country's policy towards Israel, is it not, in effect, confirming the conclusions of the report?" Well, this week was the 80th anniversary of the arrest of H.L. Mencken on Boston Common. Mencken was challenging free speech laws by selling his magazine, The American Mercury, which authorities said contained obscene material. Bill Mark spoke with biographer Marion Elizabeth Rogers about the event, and that prompted Nancy Mullen Erskine to contact us. She said that family lore had it that her grandfather, John Mullen, a sales manager for Viking Press, was there that day.
He asked my grandfather to come. Once the sale was made, they were all arrested.
So your grandfather was there in support of H.L. Mencken?
Oh, yes.
Well, this is family lore, but you'd also like to have it verified.
I would like to, yes, exactly, because partly I hope my grandfather got credit for that. He was really quite a modest man. But also it would be nice to know a little bit more about it.
Well, Nancy, you're going to have to keep that story filed in the family lore file for now. Author Marion Rogers says she has no knowledge of John Mullen. But it's a great story. And finally, we heard from Derek Volkart of Ashland, Oregon, after our piece on concerns over released Christian Science Monitor journalist Jill Carroll. Many Americans speculated that she might be suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, or identification with her kidnappers, after she expressed sympathy for them in a video. Jill has since renounced those words. But Derek writes, "Before we get carried away with concern about Stockholm Syndrome, let us hear more of what Jill has to say about the current environment in that country. Perhaps she also has a valid view of the country that can't be dismissed as a result of stress or syndrome. If we want to talk about Stockholm Syndrome, we should talk about The Band, an incredibly talented mix of successful musicians led by frontman Jerry Joseph of Portland, Oregon. Wow, Derek, way to get your favorite band plugged. And here they are. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. People who collect old newspapers, coins, and so much more. Linda Stanley collects sea glass, those bits of glass that glitter in the sand. Here's a sound portrait of Linda Stanley from producer Lou Olkowski.
Somewhere along the 3,000 miles of Maine coastline, Linda Stanley walks slowly, with bucket in hand, carefully looking down.
You really have to look.
She's bent over, her face close to the sand. Linda is sea glassing.
Because it's a piece of green, but it's way too shiny, way too sharp. This is a nice piece, though.
So I'll take that. I'll take that home.
Sea glassing is just beachcombing, looking for little fragments of glass worn down by the ocean.
That's kind of an interesting piece.
Serious collectors like Linda also collect sea shards, pieces of pottery or porcelain from broken old teacups and china. Linda won't say where she goes to collect. That's a big secret. But she will tell us how and why she collects these treasures.
I've taken friends of mine with me and sworn them to secrecy. And I'm so excited, you know, we get there and I'm just like, oh, I can't wait to get on the beach and start looking. And I don't think they're taking it seriously enough. You know, they're just like kicking their feet and feeding the seagulls. And, you know, it's like, no, this is really important. Once you hit the beach, you have your little bucket and head down. For me, I sort of like plot out a grid. Very little talking. Talking can be distracting. I'm using my feet to shove the rocks and shells away so that I can expose more beach. Oh, look! See? It's a little bit shiny on the edges. It has a pitted feel to it. And when it has a pitted feel, that's a good sign. There are rare colors. The most common is white and brown. And then from there it goes to different shades of greens. And the oranges, the pinks, and the reds are the most rare colors. I actually probably have grown a little bit more fond of pottery than the sea glass, because with the pottery, I mean, you can just find so many different colors and patterns and shapes. So it's a little bit more exciting to me. I have a stoneware plate full of my sea shards. It's part of my living room decor. Let me see what else is in here that's really wonderful. This probably is one of my absolute favorites. This is a piece of stoneware, porcelain, with a green and white patina, and it has a deer's head with a full rack of antlers in the corner, which is very unusual. Most people who walk the beaches now, they find like a piece here, a piece there. It's not like you go out and just find, you know, walk on a beach on the coast of Maine and find all sorts of sea glass or sea shards. This took a long time to collect. This is probably maybe 15 years to find as many pieces that are really considered collectible. I mean, and sometimes my husband jokes. We'll have company and he'll say, oh, well, yeah, Linda's been sea glassing. And he acts like he's right on the verge of telling people. And I tense up. I think, oh, my God, he's going to give away my secrets. It's not like it's, you know, undiscovered. I mean, it is in a remote location. There is still a working wharf there. But I would say at one time that a lot of families used it as a dump site. And I think that's one of the reasons why it has so much, why the beach has so much wash up on it now. The first time I went, I thought I was going to hyperventilate. To me, it just looked like a china closet had gone crazy. That's somebody had emptied their whole china closet. And thank God I had taken along two buckets. I was just so excited that I couldn't couldn't stop myself. I'm just filling up the buckets, you know. Could have been like buckets of gold. I will tell you, though, I took a lot of stuff that I shouldn't have. It just wasn't, it wasn't ready. It wasn't cooked. I think that you should not keep a piece of glass if it's too rough and too sharp and too shiny. It hasn't had time to age, and just toss it back. This is just worn to perfection. There's hardly anything about this yellow and white piece that isn't perfect. I was talking to somebody about collecting beach glass and shards and stuff, and they said, well, what do you do with them? You know, why do you keep it? So, I mean, I just knew that it was a, you know, why continue the conversation? She would never grasp the, you know, the whole concept of collecting beach glass. Oh, my word. This is a red piece of glass. Oh, my God, it's red, and look how beautiful it is. This is really a great piece of glass. It's wonderful. Oh, this is lucky. That's really lucky.
Our portrait of Linda Stanley came from producer Lou Alkowski. And we're also sending you our apologies. We had promised a profile of Meryl Streep at this moment, and boy, we would love to hear it as well, but we're going to have to wait till Monday. We've had technical gremlins in the mix, and so our story, our visit with Meryl Streep, we'll have for you on Monday. But right now, a look at stories we'll be following in the coming days. The Senate sidetracked sweeping immigration legislation today amid partisan recriminations, leaving in doubt prospects for passage of a measure that offered the hope of citizenship to millions of men, women, and children living in the U.S. illegally. This as Congress will begin a two-week break starting Monday. The vote marked a turnabout from Thursday when the Senate's two leaders had both hailed a last-minute compromise as a breakthrough in the campaign to enact the most far-reaching changes in immigration law in two decades. And in the Middle East, a senior Hamas official said Friday that group is ready to accept a two-state solution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But the Hamas prime minister said he's unaware of plans by the Islamic militants to change their hardline government platform. The senior Hamas official said the two-state idea was to be raised by Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh in a meeting today with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, a moderate who advocates negotiations with Israel. We'll keep a close eye on that story. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Vince Fairchild, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. And our thanks today to Vince Fairchild, who's had quite a day. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.